Hey, we're back with another edition of our Little Movies Digital Radio Show and Podcast. It is We've Seen That. I'm TJ Reeves. He is the famous JJ Betzel. And by the way, we've seen that on social media through Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. You can also subscribe to this show through iTunes and Stitcher. However you found us through Blog Talk Radio, whatever the case is, thanks for finding us. Famous Jay, good to be back with you, sir.
Likewise, sir. So it's spring training, a lot of baseball going on. It's time to do a Kevin Costner movie. What Kevin Costner movie are we going to do?
Well, yeah, but it's kind of fitting. We've done a lot of sports movies that it's also Oscar season at the time that we're talking in February. And so you were right away all over this like weeks ago that, hey, around the Oscars, we got to do Costner, Whitney Houston, and The Bodyguard. So
exactly. Let me explain this because people probably hear that and they're like, what are you talking about? My thoughts were just kind of have a little bit of fun with it because, you know, we could have easily done Ordinary People or Chariots of Fire or Gandhi or Forrest Gump, something that's like very, very Oscar-centric. But this particular movie, while it was nominated for two Oscars, it dominated the Razzie nominations. Are you familiar with those?
Yeah, right. Not a good thing to dominate.
Yeah, it's
not
the worst of the movies, and they're announced usually the night before the Oscars. And also, about half of this movie, at least a third of this movie, takes place at the Academy Awards. So we just thought we'd have a little bit of fun with Oscar season and do the 1992 Kevin Costner, Whitney Houston film, The Bodyguard.
All right, so it's only appropriate. Let's do it officially.
Frank Farmer to see Miss Marin.
What?
Alexander Graham Bell to see Miss Marin.
All right.
Bill said he used to be with the Secret Service.
There was 2 years with Carter, four with Reagan.
Reagan got shot.
Not on my ship.
All my colors for you.
All right.
You don't look like a bodyguard.
This is my disguise.
Well, his timing's good.
Henry, I've spent a lot of time guarding people all over the world, and I found one thing to be true. No matter how incompetent the assassins, no matter how much they miss their target, there's one person who always gets hit.
Who?
The cocky black chauffeur.
You afraid I might get picked off my snazzy running suit?
No, I'm afraid that I'm gonna have to jog with you.
Someone was in my house? Wait a minute, someone was in my house?
Everybody's afraid of something. That's how we know we care about things. When we're afraid we'll lose it.
How about you, Frank Farmer, out there on the edge?
Rachel, I don't want to get confused about what I'm doing here.
I'm not confused.
You pay me to protect you. That's what I do.
Then what is it?
I'm afraid of not being there.
There you have it, The Bodyguard, starring Kevin Costner, Whitney Houston. It was released November 25th, 1992. It was the Wednesday before Thanksgiving. It opened up against some stiff competition. It was actually number three opening behind the week before we saw Home Alone 2. It repeated as number one. The day Bodyguard came out, it opened against Aladdin.
Wow.
So for its opening weekend, it grossed $24 million back in 1992 and came in third place. But it wasn't all bad news for the box office because when it was all said and done, it made $411 million worldwide off a $25 million budget. What do you think about that?
It's amazing. I didn't realize that, and I would have lost a bet to you that this one did that well. I mean, I remember this movie having success. I didn't even remember when you said there at the beginning it had some Academy Award buzz too, as part of this with Costner and Whitney Houston, and so I didn't realize, and this is why I love it on We've Seen That when we go back and start to review these movies, that it was that big of a deal. He has so many other movies in and around this time frame that were such a big deal. I guess Costner was just on a roll, and so was Whitney Houston, too.
Right. This was Whitney Houston's film debut, actually. And Kevin Costner, of course, was on the heels of Dances with Wolves and Field of Dreams,
yep,
and all of his baseball movies. Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves had come out the year before. Let's take a quick look at some box office for Kevin Costner, just because this is a smaller cast, so we can talk about him a little bit. His number one movie of all time is Dances with Wolves, followed by Robin Hood. Then there was The Man of Steel. Remember the Superman movie back in 13?
Oh, right, right. But that's much more recent.
The father.
Right, right, right.
Correct.
Right.
And then number four is The Bodyguard, ahead of all of his baseball movies. JFK, Tin Cup, this beat all of them. It did that
again,
well.
I would have lost a bet to you that Tin Cup or Bull Durham or Field of Dreams or one of those would not have done well enough to be in that top four in front of The Bodyguard. So
yeah, The Untouchables. I mean, there's all these classics he's been in, and this is number four ahead of all of them. So
how much of that? But wait, but how much of that is him, and how much of that is Whitney Houston in this case? What's your opinion on that?
For box office, a combination of both, because you have to remember he was one of the biggest movie stars in the world when this came out. You know, and also back 25 years ago, the interracial romance was controversial, but
of
the
course.
Fact that it was, you know, Whitney Houston was loved by white America and Kevin Costner was loved by everybody. So it's like it wasn't even really a factor in the story.
You know what's sad?
It came out in 92, a year after Jungle Fever, where the entire movie was about that.
That's correct. And what's sad is it's 25 years later and it's still an issue at how we vote, at how we look at things, how we view things. And it still causes a problem for some. But you make a good point. And you know, the other thing that I'm thinking here, too, in terms of how hot he was as an actor, she was white hot as well, to use that metaphor, because she had such a massive, successful singing career, and she had sung the national anthem for the Super Bowl, Super Bowl 25 in Tampa, where I live. Arguably, the most famous national anthem at a sporting event ever. Would you maybe go along with that? And she had done that in and around filming this movie, the time frame of filming this movie.
Right. You know, that's one of those things where it was what was going on in the war with the Gulf War at the time and everything.
Right.
It was just a magical moment. And the funny thing is, I remember when people would talk about, oh, well, it was, you know, recorded and lip synced, whatever. Like, who cares? It was a great moment for the country and kind of brought a lot of people together. And then during 9/11, it was one of those that they would play on the radio because it was inspirational, you know, and just there was something just magical about Whitney Houston. And it came across in this movie. And you mentioned earlier that it was an Oscar nominated movie. Both the nominations belonged to her. It was I Have Nothing and Run to You were both nominated for Best Original Song.
How about that?
So that's where the Oscar nominations come from. And the story itself, let's kind of just dive right in. It's based on Rachel Maron, who's played by Whitney Houston. She's an Academy Award-nominated music superstar. And her manager, Mr. Devaney, brings in the services of professional bodyguard Frank Farmer, who is played by Kevin Costner. And he's really well-known in this kind of the world, protecting, you know, VIPs like celebrities, heads of companies, heads of state. And he had been in the Secret Service. And when he was in the Secret Service, he was on President Reagan's detail. And he missed a day because his mother had passed away. So he went to his mother's funeral. And the day he missed was the day that President Reagan was shot. So he's got kind of these ghosts that kind of haunt him from that. And that's kind of part of why he stepped away from Secret Service. So, you know, there's kind of a little backstory on Mr. Frank Farmer there. And when you see him, you know, he's got like the really short haircut. He looks like the kind of guy who came straight out of the military, like a no-nonsense. Everything's black and white. And then he's thrown into this world, you know, by Mr. Devaney hiring him to come take care of Whitney Houston because she's got a stalker who has penetrated her house and left notes. And her management team, Mr. Devaney, played by Bill Cobbs, who we saw in That Thing You Do, amongst many other movies. And then Cy Spector, who is like the weasel of the movie. He's played by Gary Kemp, who we know from the band Spandau Ballet.
Well,
he was the lead singer of that band. And he's just a snake. And he doesn't want, you know, all he cares about is money and fame. And like they showed the bedroom that the stalker had broken into in the house. And he was bragging to Kevin Costner that it was featured in a magazine. You know, and that's all he cares about. He's so shallow and so phony. But obviously, she needs someone of Farmer's, you know, capabilities and talents to protect her. And ironically, it kind of opens Farmer up. So it turns out he needs her, too.
Well, and you know, you're talking about those Hollywood types. The Cy Spector character, it may be based on an individual or it could be like a compilation of two or three different weaselly Hollywood types. They're always around, it seems like, or at least that's the stereotype, that they're always around all of the stars, the mega stars. They have to have somebody like that that's kind of in the way, that thinks they know everything, that's messing everything up. So those are the principles that kind of set the movie into motion. And I think it's interesting at the beginning that Costner kind of has to be convinced that he wants to be even around around that Frank wants to be around Rachel and even want this job at all. And he's negotiating like in the backyard of his house while throwing knives. While Bill Devaney comes over to sell him on the job, he's throwing knives like for target practice at a post while he's trying to accept the job. So,
the funny thing is, Mr. Devaney is kind of, he's the only one that sees what's going on. You know, he has to convince Rachel to hire him. He has to convince Farmer to take the job. None of the people that work for Rachel, including her existing bodyguard, who's played by Mike Starr, which a lot of people will remember from Dumb and Dumber. He's the one that Jeff Daniels and Jim Carrey gave him the red hots, you know, and basically gave him a heart attack in the middle of the diner. So that's the guy who plays Tony, who was her former bodyguard. And he's around, you know, because he tells Frank, he's there because he loves her, not because he's some hired gun. You know, but he also, same thing, he grows to respect Frank, not only because Frank beats his ass in the kitchen, but also because he sees that Frank knows what he's doing. And he's like, this guy is here. It's in the, you know, best interest of Rachel to have him here. And, you know, kind of when you're watching the movie, you know, a lot of times we talk about how they're filmed. This one kind of has like an eerie look to it. Like a lot of times it's kind of foggy, you know, it kind of looks like it could have been made in the 70s or the 80s, although it did come out in 92. And kind of want to mention that it was Lawrence Kasdan, who's a really well-known screenwriter director. This was his first ever script, and he wrote it in the mid-70s. And it was originally supposed to star Steve McQueen and Diana Ross.
How about that?
The reason it did not get made was the studio was afraid.
This is why
interracial romance.
And it's the 70s, and it's you know, much less.
And there's a Hollywood aspect to it too. Is neither of them would accept second billing in the movie, so it just didn't get made.
total Hollywood thing. How about my man, the famous Jay, on We've Seen That, coming strong with Steve McQueen and Diana Ross? I had never heard that before, that they could have been the original special agent, the Secret Service retired agent, bodyguard, and the famous actress, singer. I guess Diana Ross was too busy making The Wiz with Michael Jackson in the 70s, and McQueen was making all of his action movies that he was doing to be able to come together and figure this out. But, you know, it's also, in a lot of ways, I think you and I would agree, Whitney Houston had no problem playing this role as Rachel Maron, because it's probably mirroring a lot of her life, her anecdotes, and things that were going on with her.
Right, and she even has admitted that she was nervous to have her first role be, you know, such a huge production against an A-list actor like Kevin Costner. And back to Steve McQueen for just a second, there was another rendition that could have been made of The Bodyguard with Diana Ross and her then boyfriend, Ryan O'Neal. And the reason that one did not get made is the two of them broke up and she refused to work with him. So that's how we ended up getting this particular version. And Kevin Costner said he was inspired by Steve McQueen and he cut his hair like Steve McQueen's in Towering Inferno. Have that look. It all comes back around. But no, I do agree. She essentially played herself in a lot of ways. Now, granted, Rachel Maron's not a very nice person. You know, she's mean to her sister. She's just awful to Frank. You know, for the most part, anytime Frank does something with her best interests are, she gets mad.
Wait a minute. Tell her to do You're one talking thing about and then she does the stereotypical Hollywood type, musician type, not having any use for the people that help her and work around her and protect her and keep her safe. I'm shocked that actually goes on.
Essentially, that's what I'm saying. And then, of course, you know, they go to a nightclub. There's a scene where they go to a nightclub where she's promoting her latest record. And that's how long ago this movie was. It's related to quote-unquote record. You can see my air quotes that we always talk about. And, you know, Frank Farmer wants her to not be there. He's like, you know, you've got somebody trying to kill you, stalking you. Why would we go to a nightclub full of people? And, you know, of course, all hell breaks loose while they're there. And that's
first of all, she comes out looking like a cross between an actress in a B alien movie and maybe even remember the Gorgeous Ladies of Wrestling, the Glow Wrestling in the 80s.
Yes,
she looked like a maybe a villain from Glow Wrestling or a bad 80s or 90s sci-fi B movie actress with the outfit she's on for this music video. I mean, give me a break on that in the club. I'm surprised Whitney Houston would be seen on film wearing that stuff, but I guess it was the role, right? It was the role as Rachel.
Right. That was Rachel Maron, not Whitney Houston. And the funny thing is, you know, they're back in the dressing room. Kevin Costner's character, Frank Farmer, believes he's got her convinced this is not the right move. We don't need to do this, you know. And then Devaney's out there basically telling the crowd, "Sorry, we're not going to be able to perform." And then she says, "You know, to hell with it, I want to do this." So she comes out onto the stage, and that, you know, while she's singing, it's just there's no security procedures at all set up. While she's singing, all hell breaks loose, and Kevin Costner takes her out the side door to the limo and essentially leaves Cy and Tony and everybody there. So that doesn't do him any favors for the guys that already don't want him to be around. But it also kind of gets to the point where Devaney and opens up and explains to Rachel, kind of lets her know really more of what's going on. The fact that someone's been in the house and, you know, and she's in a lot more danger than Cy's led her to believe. And that's when they kind of go to the point where they need to kind of step out of the Hollywood limelight, if you will. Right. And so they go to Kevin Costner's dad's house. And his father's played by Ralph Waite from the Waltons. You remember that?
Yes, the dad on the Waltons.
John Boy's dad.
He's famous for that, and he's in a few other movies. But yeah, it's kind of interesting that around that time frame, he's playing kind of the elder statesman, and he's Frank Farmer's dad here in this instance. And they got to go to a secluded place, they think, to kind of hide out, regroup, reset mentally, keep her safe, at least so they think, right?
Well, and the beauty of it is that he has no clue who Rachel Maron is. So there's a part where he says, "You must be important if you need somebody like Frank to take care of you." He tells me you're a singer. You know, so that's kind of funny just to see, because it reminds people, you know, hey, we're just people. You know, not everyone knows who you are. You may seem like it, but it all depends on the setting. You know, and while we're there, you know, they think that, or Frank certainly thinks, you know, he's left Devaney, he's left Tony, he's left Cy, everybody back in L.A. And basically thinks that they'll be in a safe spot. And at one moment he's kind of down by the boat, you know, playing with Fletcher, who is Rachel Maron's son.
Right.
And they're down there playing. And she mentions to the father, to Frank's father, that Fletcher can't swim. And basically the father says, "We better stay in the boat," you know, just, you know, typical, you know, old person's response. But then, yeah, you know, that kind of sets it up for later on. He takes the boat out on his own. Fletcher does. And Frank goes out, jumps in the water, you know, the freezing cold water, because they're in the mountains, you know, pulls the kid to the side. Of course, Rachel, rather than saying thank you for saving him, she starts screaming at him how you're out of your mind and this and that, you know, about how dare you do this to my son? You could have killed him. He could have drowned. And then the boat explodes. So then we're back into, you know, 1980s TV show mode where everybody's running around trying to do stuff and they're trying to figure out, you know, the cables are cut in the cars and they're trying to figure out, you know, oh, my gosh, first off, how did anybody find us?
Right.
You know, and of course, the dad even mentions maybe it has something to do with you as opposed to her. You know, and there's all these subtle little hints throughout the movie about who this is that's coming after her. You know, and you see the stalker. He's just a horrible looking guy. He's got long blonde hair. He always looks really sad. And you see him. And so the movie has it set up for you to think it's him. But it turns out, as we find out at the mountain retreat, that Rachel's sister, out of just pure hatred and jealousy for Rachel, has hired a professional hitman to kill Rachel. And he will not stop until it's done. So not only are we dealing with these nutcase fans of hers,
of course,
we're also dealing with nutcase, a professional hitman.
And nutcase family and professional,
yes,
hitmen. And again, these kind of stories, they float around all the time in the world of entertainment, the movies, television, music, sports. You know, you would think, how crazy would it be that a family member would try to kill another family member? This kind of stuff goes on. It happens.
You know, and so much emotion and hatred and stuff. And my apologies, I jumped ahead a little bit. While Rachel was being protected by Frank, she and Frank slept together.
Yes.
Because Rachel was basically like, "You won't let me go spend time with my friends. I can't go on a date, so I guess I need to go on a date with you." And so while they're out to eat, they hear the Dolly Parton version of "I Will Always Love You," the famous song. And then, of course, they end up going to the movies where they see the Japanese movie Yojimbo from 1961, which translated into English is The Bodyguard.
How about that?
So just a little fun note there. So anyways, and then, of course, he tells her after they slept together, he's like, "I can't protect you like this." So he essentially tells her, you know, "I'm one and done." And so she gets really mad at him. And they end up going to the Fountain Blue Hotel in Miami. You've got the Entertainment Tonight music, John Tesh talking. There's a big charity event they're there for. And while they're there, Frank runs into one of his old Secret Service buddies named Portman. Okay. And if you're paying close attention to the very beginning, when Mr. Devaney is in Frank's backyard, Frank says, "There's other guys that are better with celebrities. That's not for me." And he lists off a couple of guys, you know, one of them being Portman. And Mr. Devaney says, "Portman was interested, but I heard you're the best." So, you know, Portman's kind of been casually, nonchalantly mentioned throughout the movie.
There's little
then
hints.
You see him in Miami, and to try and make Frank jealous, Rachel takes Portman out of their conversation, takes him back to the bedroom, and then realizes Frank's not coming in after her and basically kicks him out of the bedroom. She's like, Tony, Mr. Portman was just leaving. You know, and then shortly thereafter is whenever she finds out, I believe that, you know, that's when she decides that, you know, we need to, I'll listen to you now, because I believe Fletcher has been kind of brought into this, and she realizes that the problems are a lot worse than she was led to believe.
And look, Frank has always got her best interest, Costner, at heart here, protecting her. I mean, he's the one that carried her out of the club, remember? And that's the indelible image that's on the movie poster.
Right.
I mean, Frank ultimately cares about her. I want to go back a step to you mentioning John Tesh, Mary Hart, Entertainment Tonight. I mean, the millennials these days, the sub-30-year-olds, they don't have any idea who we're talking about. But if you were on that show, that was like the seal of approval in terms of Hollywood, movies, music, entertainment. So it's kind of fun that they interweave them into this movie just to, you know, and I'm sure part of it was get some extra promotion through Entertainment Tonight by having Tesh and those guys on. Now they're going to, you know, they're going to interview Costner. They're going to interview Whitney Houston for real, put them on the movie even more. So, yeah, a big shout out for John Tesh. John Tesh made his way finally onto We've Seen That here, because we used to see him all the time back in the 90s. And few realize and remember that in addition to Tesh's skill and his talent in being a broadcaster and being on Entertainment Tonight, he was also a musician. He also wrote music. He also wrote the theme song for the NBA coverage on NBC, for NBC television, because he had done a bunch of work for NBC and NBC Sports. So Tesh was like a multi-talented guy. So good job on the shout out and the connection there to Entertainment Tonight. And again, that was the big deal back in the late 80s and the early 90s. If you were on Entertainment Tonight in that half hour show, you were a big deal in entertainment. So they wove it into the movie.
When I remember too, that watching Entertainment Tonight for someone who loves sports, that was kind of like movie fans' version of SportsCenter, where now we have E, which is like Entertainment Tonight 24/7, you know, right, minus the Kardashians. You know, and that was like when SportsCenter was there. You know, you didn't have ESPN News or even the dearly departed CNN SI that we had for a while. You know, that was what you had. So it was really cool. And hearing that music, it just kind of got you in the mind frame of movies and entertainment, which this was. It was in the entertainment world. So after they're in the mountains or whatever, and they decide they're going to stay overnight and leave first thing in the morning because the cars have been – they've had their cables cut, right? So they can't get out. So he said, we're going to stay the night here. We'll leave first thing because we can't walk with the two women and the child at night. You know, it's just too dangerous. So while they're there, the killer comes into the house. And Kevin Costner had just discovered what was going on, because he had been talking to Rachel's sister, and she admitted it. She was drinking. She said she got stoned one night and hired this guy. And the guy comes in the house and he shoots the sister. So the sister's murdered, and they end up getting out, because Kevin Costner chases the guy off because he shoots at him, and it's really cool. He goes out in the dark, he closes his eyes and listens, and he almost hits him because he starts shooting. He starts turning and shooting for what he hears, and then the guy gets away, of course. So next thing we know, we're back at back in Los Angeles, and Rachel Marin's mansion that Frank has made it similar to Fort Knox compared to what it was when he first went there and was able to get in, saying he was Alexander Graham Bell and Henry Ford. You know, he's turned that into this, you know, this very safe haven. And just throw this out there real quick. That house is the same house from The Godfather where the horse's head was in the bed.
How about that?
And Alan Stanwyck's house from Fletch.
Oh, so, big time. I love that.
If you're a friend of mine on Facebook, yes. It's my picture on my Facebook, too.
I love that. All right, so if we befriend the famous Jay, we can see this. So not only the Godfather house, but it's also Alan Stanwyck and Mrs. Stanwyck's house, and it is also used in this movie as well. And, you know, we talked about that. We've talked about different houses and different things being used, different locations, wasn't it? Well, we just talked recently that basically the same high school was used when we talked about the Breakfast Club, and that Ferris Bueller's Day Off, which will probably be a future, we've seen that used the same high school. And wasn't it on there was a previous one, I think it's Christmas Vacation, that we did on We've Seen That, where the house was also used in the Lethal Weapon movies, is what you told me, right? They make
correct,
use of the same
right,
houses
the back
over
lot of the Warner Brothers lot, and it was the same street. Correct.
How about that? So they make use of the same house in different ways. And I'll just quote Fletch briefly since you brought it up. I'll just show myself out and we'll catch the last 20 minutes of Dynasty. Continue.
Exactly.
Continue on while we're in the Stanwyck's house. Yes.
So she's sitting outside, and you mentioned on that particular episode you referenced The Breakfast Club about the powers of persuasion. She
yes.
goes outside and talks to Frank because the Oscars are coming up, and he does not want her to go because the threat is still there. And she says, she kind of jokes around, you know, butters up to him, says that she's got this bet with a bunch of her friends about her winning an Oscar. She's like, so you got to understand that I really want to go because if I win, I'm in for a lot of money. You know, so he basically sweet talks him into letting her go because he didn't want her to go. So here we are. We're at the Academy Awards, which as we're broadcasting today, we are in early 2018, like 3/1/2018 is the date we're broadcasting. It will come up later. But we were just right before the 2018 Oscars. So that's kind of part of why we are even doing this movie, as we mentioned earlier.
Right.
And then the Oscars ceremony here is broadcast similar to what ABC does. You know, when they show it's a huge event, you've got the red carpet, you've got all the movie stars and all the movers and shakers in LA and the entertainment world. One of those being Rachel Maron. And then, of course, that means we have Cy and we have Tony and we have Mr. Devaney. Her whole entourage is back. She is talking to Frank backstage, and he's, you know, of course, he's still as nervous as can be because not only is it his job to make sure nothing happens to her, you know, but he also, as you find throughout the movie, he cares about her, you know. While we can't understand why, because she's awful to him, but that's just how it is. And he really doesn't want her to be doing this, but she goes out, and part of her seeing him and seeing how concerned he is, because he's just got a feeling it's going to happen here on this huge stage, you know, like the Super Bowl of entertainment world is the Oscars.
Of course.
And so she goes out and she is presenting award, and she basically has a meltdown on stage. And then she's in backstage screaming about how Frank has made her mad, or, you know, made her crazy, and it's all his fault. And she just wants to be left alone. And basically she ends up going back out in the crowd because, you know, she's got to be in the seats for the presentation of Best Actress, which she, of course, is going to win because we know this is a movie.
Of course, it's Hollywood.
So Kevin Costner's looking around. He bumps into none other than Portman, our friend who we saw in Miami that worked in the Secret Service with Frank. And he says, hey, Portman, what are you doing here? And he says, I'm on the job. And he's like, who? And he points at the TV talking about the host, who's played by Robert Wool,
right,
who we know from Arliss.
Right, because he did Arliss.
He was
a comedian. He was in Bull Durham with Costner. He was a comedian,
right,
and he became very well known for Arliss right after that. But I thought that was interesting in rewatching this and getting ready to do this podcast. Is he playing a character there, or is he playing Robert Wool? I don't know which. I mean, I don't know if he's playing himself.
Fun little fact, Mr. T.J. Reeves.
Please, give it to me.
He was a writer for the Oscars for Billy Crystal. So he's essentially playing his version of Billy Crystal.
There we go.
As the host. So we all know for our lifetime, Billy Crystal's the very best we've ever had do the Oscars.
Well,
it was like for sports fans having Pat Summerall and John Madden do a football game. That's how Billy Crystal was. It just brought something else to the Oscars.
Well, and different people have tried it different ways, and you always got to have great writers for the different jokes, the different segues. So it's interesting that Will did that, and now he's playing in that role here as part of the movie. And I mean, you can tell they're building to the big dramatic conclusion of the movie. Even a quick cameo there from Richard Schiff, who's best known as Toby on The West Wing for that tremendously acclaimed series. And I'll even tie that back to Kevin Costner in a second in Secret Service Agents. But Richard Schiff, even as like the stage manager, is telling Rachel, telling Whitney Houston, you got to go get in your seat because you may be about to win an Academy Award. And that's what sets everything in motion for the climactic end.
Yeah, he is in freakout mode, Richard Schiff, I'm speaking of, because nothing is going right, you know, as far as Rachel goes, because she had her little meltdown, and she's just furious, and he just wants everything to go smooth, and, you know, she keeps having arguments with her people and everything, and basically he's like, go sit in your seat, it's almost that time. So Portman has told Kevin Costner that he is there protecting the host, he's his body guy, and he says, got to go to work. So then a few minutes later, you know, it kind of hits Kevin Costner. Wait a minute. This is way too many coincidences. And the host is walking past him, and he says, where's Portman? And he goes, never heard of him. So he knows, and the audience knows, Portman is the man who has been hired to kill Rachel Maron. So Frank Farmer is trying to contact, you know, Rachel's other bodyguard, Tony, via his little radio to say, hey, it's going to happen tonight. It's Portman. keep your eyes open. He's going to do it. He's here. He's going to do it. And then the backstage people of the Oscars take his radio away because it's messing up their mics. So he tries to call Tony, and he doesn't have his mic. He sees Portman across the stage right as Whitney Houston is announced as the winner of the Best Actress. So, of course, they're playing the music. She's getting the standing ovation. She's coming up. She's so happy. He sees Portman on the other side of the stage with a camera that has got like a laser. It's like one of those little red lasers.
A scope. You know,
that kind of zooms in. Exactly like a scope.
Yep.
And he is zoomed in on her, and he's got the shot. And so, I mean, obviously this couldn't happen today, as you know, the way that the world is. But, you know, because of security being so much tighter everywhere. But Kevin Costner literally runs out on the stage and saves her life. He takes her down and takes a bullet. And, you know, as everybody's running out, of course, there's mass chaos. Everybody running around. There's blood all over. And they think that she's been shot. And they think she's been shot by Kevin Costner, that he took the stage and shot at her. But she's like, no, he's my bodyguard. You know, and then he looks up and sees Portman about to take another shot, and he shoots him. He shoots him right between the eyes, and basically the camera explodes.
It was a typical Hollywood good guy versus bad guy moment. It looks like Kevin Costner's shot. He's going to bleed to death. He's going to maybe die, but then suddenly I have enough wherewithal to turn, see the bad guy, and oh, by the way, Famous Jay, I'm the only one that sees the bad guy because I can only be I have to be the superhero. I'm the only one that sees him, and I have to be the one to shoot him and take him out, and that's exactly what Farmer does.
People thought that Farmer's the one that was doing it because he charged the stage. But he ends up saving her life.
You know, it didn't occur to me. But it didn't occur to me that he might be the guy. I think he's trying to figure out who the guy is, and there were different twists earlier, but it never occurred to me that Frank Farmer might actually be the killer or be the hitman. No.
I think the people in the audience just saw him running on stage. I don't think they knew who he was.
No, I got you. I misunderstood. You're talking about in the fictitious Academy Award
setting.
They don't know what's going on because we've got gunfire. We've got Rachel's run off the stage once already tonight. Now she's being tackled here by Frank to save her, and gunshots are being fired. So a very chaotic scene at the end of those Academy Awards.
We know, as we're doing this, last year's Academy Awards, remember, they announced the wrong winner for Best Picture. they said La La Land, and everybody came out, and it turned out that Moonlight was the winner. So, I mean,
one of the more amazing gaffes in the history of live TV, where two famous actor and actresses are standing there, and the one that has the envelope looks at the what's on the card that says Best Actress Emma Stone and can't figure out I have the wrong envelope. It would have made for so much more of a dramatic moment. Instead, I mean, I got to belittle those two that are standing there, Warren Beatty and who was it, Faye Dunaway was standing
correct.
There. How do one of those, you know, not turn their brain on and read the card and see that it says Best Actress Emma Stone for La La Land and realize I have the wrong card? But you're right, that's nothing compared to these 1992 Academy Awards with Rachel Maron almost getting shot on stage after being the best
back
actress.
To the real Oscars for just a minute. You know, there was the urban legend that back in 1992 when Marissa Tomei won Best Supporting Actress for My Cousin Vinny, that it was supposed to be Vanessa Redgrave. She was the one that was supposed to win, but that Jack Palance had either been given the wrong card or said who he wanted to win instead of who was supposed to win, whether it was some kind of reason he didn't want Vanessa Redgrave to have it, but he had won the year previously for City Slickers, so he was presenting. And so there's a lot of urban legends there, and you know, a lot of it might be the night of Hollywood types.
And that was the night, you can see this on YouTube, wasn't that the night that he was doing the push-ups on stage, the one-arm push-ups, in addition to reading the wrong card, or at least declaring his own winner for the Oscar. So they've had some gaffes, but they've never had any shootings like this or anything chaotic
and last
like that.
Year's was the PricewaterhouseCooper guy. I guess he gave the wrong envelope because he was back in they were doing selfies, you know, and tweeting out pictures of him with celebrities. So there's all kinds of stuff there. But no, as I digress, back to the movie. If the Pricewaterhouse guy was there with the wrong envelope, he probably would have been shot by Portman.
But in the end, Frank gets his guy and is able to shoot him. Now, you know, what's interesting is the character, the former Secret Service agent Farmer. It's intertwined in other movies, a later movie, Clint Eastwood's movie, In the Line of Fire, and his character, who's also He's also Frank, right? In the Line of Fire, going after John Malkovich. And he ends up getting shot in the huge moment, in the huge sequence. And then I'm also, speaking of Richard Schiff and the West Wing, I'm thinking back to that series where Mark Harmon, who is a tremendous actor from the 80s, the 90s, and now in the present day, we know him from NCIS in the present day. But Harmon made a very famous cameo for about two or three episodes on the West Wing as a Secret Service bodyguard for Allison Janney's character, C.J. Craig, the press secretary, because same thing, Jay. C.J. Craig is getting death threats as the White House press secretary. He's assigned to her as the bodyguard, as a Secret Service agent, and he turns out getting compromised because he starts having feelings for her. They essentially fall in love. So it's almost like Aaron Sorkin in The West Wing is rewriting a bit of The Bodyguard, because ultimately, I'm doing the spoiler alert, The West Wing has now been off the air for more than 10 years. It ends up that Mark Harmon's character, Simon Donovan, gets shot to death because he lets his guard down while guarding Allison Janney, while guarding CJ. He lets his guard down. He ends up getting killed on the show.
Yeah, correct me if I'm wrong. Yeah. Wasn't it something like where he actually thought that they were going to go on a date because he was not going to be protecting her anymore, and he went to like a convenience store that was getting robbed, like walked into robbery?
That's correct.
Yeah, but similar to in The Bodyguard, when Kevin Costner let his guard down with Whitney Houston when he went on the date, but he went back to being hardcore Frank Farmer,
right?
As opposed to being Simon Donovan and being love struck.
But it is interesting how Hollywood, after The Bodyguard and after the movie was out, In the Line of Fire culminates, Secret Service agent taking the bullet for the president and ends up with the girl. Eastwood ends up with Rene Russo. And then years later on the small screen, again, we interweave a Secret Service agent, a love triangle, and he ends up getting killed in that. So they were mimicking The Bodyguard, is my point. We've seen this. They've seen it. We've seen it. And it got reproduced, essentially, a couple of times.
Apparently, they had 411 million reasons to yes. mimic it. Like, okay, apparently somebody liked this. So anyways, following the Oscars, you know, it's one of those things where you don't know. He might be dead, because Rachel's screaming, "Don't you die on me. Don't you die on me. You know, I need you. You save me." And basically, they show this airplane, and you don't know, you know, because they're kind of on a runway. You don't know if it's like his funeral or what's going on. But then you see that Frank is there. He's wearing a cast, and he's recovered from the shooting, and he's going to say goodbye to Rachel at the airport. And he's got her a new bodyguard, an older gentleman, shall we say,
right,
who's very good. But he tells her, he's like, that I don't trust you. I don't want to give you another guy that can compete with me, you know. And like, they're kind of just laughing with each other and kind of smiling. So she gets on the plane, starts to kind of taxi away, and she jumps up, and then she's like, stop. You know, they lower the stairs. She runs down and runs over and gives Frank one big kiss.
The big Hollywood kiss.
It's the Hollywood ending. You've got the I Will Always Love You playing. And then it kind of you think the movie's going to end, but it goes to a scene with Frank's next assignment. And he's protecting a U.S. congressman who is fighting the mob. And there's a priest who is using the emergency cross that he had given to Frank that Frank had given to Rachel earlier. And it's got a little button on it that if you push it, he knows you need him. and it's just, it's
that.
One of those,
right.
It's kind of a cool little ending, because he's reading from scripture where he's saying he's watching over us and protecting us, and shows Frank standing in the back, you know. It's one of those, it's a cheesy Hollywood movie, but it's really entertaining. It's fun to watch. And it's one of those where I'm really, frankly, surprised that we have not had a remake. I know that they have talked about it, that there is a musical that I believe began back in 2012 in London. And I know it's gone all over the place, because we've had it here in Fort Worth at the Bass Hall down in Sundance Square.
How about that?
We had it down there, and I actually looked at trying to go, and it was sold out, TJ Reeves.
Well, so then you know that it was popular. So I guess they kicked around the idea of the sequel. They wanted Rihanna, the famed singer, very popular singer of the
Correct.
Of the 2000s,
yeah,
to play Rihanna, and it never materialized. Just interesting that there had been talk about it, but and you mentioned that there might have been a sequel to the movie involving Costner, but it never worked out, right?
Correct. He was looking at it. He'd been talking to the studio and some producers and stuff about doing a sequel to it featuring Princess Diana. And apparently, according to what I've read, he received the first draft of the script the week that she died.
Wow.
Yeah.
And that's now been more than 20 years ago that Princess Diana died. So all kinds of different factoids in and around the bodyguard. And of course, since this time, Whitney Houston unfortunately dies of some conspiratorialists don't believe this, but it was apparently an accidental drug overdose. But she ends up dying in a hotel room in a bathtub. Mysterious circumstances.
Beverly Hills Hotel, I believe, right around the Golden Globes.
And mysterious circumstances where you're wondering after a movie like this how these things can happen and who knows and where were her security? Where was her bodyguard? How does something like this happen? So the late Whitney Houston, it's a shame that we have to say that, but the late Whitney Houston no longer with us, but forever etched in on film. All right,
let me ask you this. Can anybody do a love song better than Whitney Houston?
Probably not. I mean,
she's in the top two or three.
Yeah, she's got to be in the top two or three, including with that song. Just a phenomenal talent, that's for sure. So I wonder, I want to go back to Costner and this time frame, because when he's Ray Kinsella in Field of Dreams, when he is the colonel, and I can't remember the name off the top of my head, in Dances with Wolves, you're just enthralled with these different characters. Crash Davis in Bull Durham, when he's playing Jim Garrison, the DA in JFK.
Roy McAvoy
later in Tin Cup. But around this time period, early 90s,
Robin Hood.
I don't get that same vibe as Frank Farmer. It's just kind of a role for him here. I mean, he's much better as Tom in No Way Out with Gene Hackman and Sean Young. He's just another actor in this to me.
This is kind of how I felt. Like, one of my very favorite Kevin Costner movies, it's one that surprisingly came out at this time, 1990. It was directed by Tony Scott, called Revenge.
Yes.
Had him and Madeline Stowe, yes, Anthony Quinn. Awesome movie. He played Jay Cochran. And then, of course, Lieutenant Dunbar that you referred to in Dances with Wolves, Crash Davis. A lot of those, you know, even Ray Kinsella, he was that character. But when I was watching The Bodyguard, I was thinking, this is Kevin Costner and Whitney Houston, you know, because by then he had this little run, an amazing run that started with The Untouchables, you know, and ran through the summer or the year before with JFK and Robin Hood, you know, where he could do no wrong. It's kind of like the run Tom Hanks would have shortly after with, you know, Apollo 13, you know, Forrest Gump, Philadelphia, you know, all these movies he made that kept being huge movies and kept winning Academy Awards. It's just kind of like he was in that zone. This was kind of the end of that little run, because shortly after that, that's when we started making Wyatt Earp and Waterworld and, you know, these 5-hour long epics, you know, before he made Tin Cup and For Love of Game and kind of came back to, you know, reality for a little while. But I love Kevin Costner. I think he's a great actor. I enjoy him. I mean, and he's a good actor, but also he's a great movie star. You know, he's just one of those guys that transcends time and generations and, you know, ages and everything. And I've got a funny Kevin Costner story I told on one of the previous incarnations of We've Seen That, but I'll tell you the quick version. As I've mentioned a few times on the show, when I got out of high school, I lived in Aspen.
Right.
I couldn't decide if I wanted to study broadcasting or if I wanted to study business. So while I'm in Aspen, I've been there for a couple weeks, hadn't seen any famous people. I'm like, what the heck's going on? I'm working at this upscale country club called Maroon Creek Club. Cost $300,000 to join back in the late 90s. So I don't know what it costs now, but I'm sure it's over $500,000. And all these movie stars were supposedly belonged there. And I was like, I hadn't seen anybody. What's going on? So I get a call one day, and I'm working in the tennis area, right? Get a call from the front that says, do you guys have any open courts? And during the summer, everybody wants to play outside because, you know, it's cold 9 months of the year there. And we never have any open courts till after 12. But this one particular day, we did. Ends up, she says, put down Kevin Costner. And I'm like, oh, my God, I'm going to finally meet somebody famous. And I mean, really famous. So this guy comes back a few minutes later and starts talking to me and this assistant pro there. His name is Doug, who is another of my Fort Worth friends. And Doug and I are talking to this guy about rackets and everything. And the guy said, just want to make sure we had a court down at 11 o'clock. And Doug says, what's the name? He says, Costner. And so I'm so disappointed. I'm like, it's not even the real Kevin Costner. What's going on? So about 45 minutes, an hour later or so, actually, I left out kind of an important part. This Costner guy's talking to Doug and I. He says, y'all's accents are pretty crazy. Are y'all from Texas or whatever? And Doug says, he says, y'all from down south. He says, yeah, we're from Texas. And for the first 2 weeks I'd been there, everyone kept confusing Fort Worth with Dallas. And so I threw out, oh, by the way, we're from Fort Worth, Texas, not Dallas. And so about 45 minutes, an hour later, we see this guy coming back and we can see him off in a distance. He's got Kevin Costner with him. So I'm like, okay, cool. You know, I'm going to act cool. It's my first celebrity to be around this and that. So the guy comes up, starts talking to Doug about rackets again, and Kevin Costner is standing there across the counter just staring at me, okay? He's like there's something on my face or whatever. I'm so embarrassed. I'm like, my first chance to meet somebody famous, you know, and I've got food on my face or something, right? So I've got my David Duvall Oakleys on back then. I kind of lower him down my nose a little bit, kind of look at him like, okay, say something here. And he starts kind of pointing at me. He's like, don't I know you? And I'm like, you know, stupid 19-year-old kid, no. And he goes, I think I've seen you somewhere before. And I said, well, I'm here every day. If you've been up here, you maybe saw me up here. I'm totally playing into this, right? And having no clue where this is going. And he goes, he snaps. He's like, Fort Worth, Texas. And I'm like, yeah, that's where I'm from. He picks me up and pulls me over the counter and proceeds to say that I owe him money and he's going to beat my ass. Doug standing there is going to let him beat me up because he's just like, oh, did that just happen? And needless to say, Doug, on the way out of the club, of course, that, you know, Kevin Costner starts laughing. I start laughing because like, obviously I
because you thought you were going to get the crap beaten out of you, and now you're relieved that Kevin Costner is not going to whip up on you.
Yeah, I'm not going to get beat up by the bodyguard. So on the way out, Doug goes to lunch, and on the way out of the club, which is kind of shaped like an L, he's on the other side when he's leaving. He tells all the girls at the front desk who all happen to be from New York, and we have this fun little rivalry with all the Texas guys in the back. He tells them about what happened, and you know how the gossip game goes. Next thing, it's all over this small town that Kevin Costner beat up one of the guys that worked at the Maroon Creek Club. And it went on and on and on. You know, like we would be wearing our Maroon Creek shirts or whatever in town to go eat lunch and go to Boogie's Diner or something, and people would go, which one of y'all? And I would just raise my hand. It was me. He beat me up. You know, it just wasn't even worth trying to explain that we were having fun. So that's my fun Kevin Costner story. And he, like I said, he could not have been any cooler when I met him.
I love it. And brush with greatness.
That's my first celebrity encounter. I've had a couple since.
Okay, so I have been around. I've been around Costner a couple of times as a celebrity golfer. One of them, I live near where they used to play a Champions Tour, Seniors Tour event as a pro-am, and Costner would come play in the event. He played it a couple of times, and I was around him, and he's a pretty good golfer, decent. You know, he obviously looks the part in Tin Cup, which is another we've seen that we've done. But he really was cool with all of the fans around him, including the kids. I was very impressed with all of that, and that's part of your role in those pro-ams. And I even heard stories that even away from the course, they were having him do a couple of charitable things, and Costner was willing to do that. And again, he's a megastar. At the time that I'm seeing him, it's in the 2010s. He's already had 7 or 8 humongous hit movies, so... give him a lot of credit. And one thing that I also know, and you get this sometimes, you hear about this, he is a shy guy from a lot of accounts, even though he's famous on the screen and in a lot of ways electric on the screen, jumps off the screen at you. He's an unassuming guy in a lot of ways and doesn't necessarily want that the group knows who he is or pays attention to him. So I've heard that in examples and people interacting with him too, but A lot of starring roles. I would not put this role, I want your thought, I would not put this Frank Farmer role, though, in the top 5, maybe even the top 10 of Kevin Costner roles. Would you, from The Bodyguard, even though had box office success, what would you say?
That's tough, because I like so many of his movies. I'm a fan of his character,
all right,
Jake from
Silverado. Let me go one for one right at him. Let's go with Tom, the character that ends up being the Russian spy in No Way Out. Is he better in that? Then Frank Farmer? All right, yes. Crash Davis. Crash Davis, Bull Durham. Is he better in that than Frank Farmer?
Yes.
I got to go yes on that one. Is he better as Garrison? I mean, I've watched JFK, and I've seen it numerous times, and I believe he's Jim Garrison. I believe he is that wholeheartedly desperate that it was a conspiracy to kill Kennedy. That hands down for me, he's better than Frank Farmer in this movie. For you? No?
Probably. That one's a little closer.
What about Ray Kinsella as Field of Dreams, as the dad mows over the corn and builds the baseball field? If you build it, they will come. And he's having a catch with his dad, and everybody's crying.
At the end, whenever you tear up when he's playing catch with his dad.
Yes.
But before, when he's like, he's just kind of, he goes and kidnaps
Terrence Mann. Like, right, James Earl Jones.
Yes.
Yeah, I think we got to say yes on that one. And we got numerous other ones. Again, what's the colonel's name? You have that in front of you from
Lieutenant,
Dancing.
Lieutenant Dunbar.
Lieutenant Dunbar for like 3 hours. He's better.
That's my least favorite Kevin Costner movie, so I like Frank Farmer.
What about, but I mean, I wouldn't say Waterworld. I wouldn't say his character in Waterworld was better.
The Mariner.
The Mariner better than Frank Farmer, but I wouldn't put him, yes, this movie did well at the box office. Yes, he's famous on screen with Whitney Houston, but as far as him playing that character, I would not put that. I love him better in the 2000s movies like Mr. Brooks, where he's the killer, where he's the multimillionaire philanthropist, and he turns out that he's the killer. He's a mass murderer. He was really good in that. I mean, he's really phenomenal as Mr. Brooks, as a killer in that.
Another great movie he had was very underappreciated, with The Upside of Anger. He played Denny Davies.
Yes.
Sports radio guy. Great. I really enjoyed that.
And what about For the Love of the Game, where he's playing the pitcher? We can talk about Tim Cup McAvoy. I would not put this performance in his top five, and maybe not in his top 10, but he's had so many great performances.
I think I could say without a doubt I'd put in the top 10, even if it is number 10, but top five. You won me over with your power of persuasion. Right. So, hey, I know we're getting towards the end of the show, and I wanted to make sure we mentioned a couple things that were really important to this movie, and I just want to make sure our audience got in on this, is that you mentioned the late Whitney Houston earlier in the show, and I just wanted to throw out that, in case anyone did not know, Kevin Costner and Whitney Houston are so tied together from this movie that Kevin Costner actually did the eulogy at Whitney Houston's funeral back in February 2012 when she passed away.
Wow.
Isn't that crazy?
Well, and I mean, you can obviously understand, because they were together filming this movie for weeks and for months. They're in most of the scenes together, so they obviously had a bond. But that, I mean, what an honor. As big a star as she obviously was, that he's the one that got to do the eulogy.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's like a 17-minute long video you can find on YouTube. I took some notes from the beginning where he starts talking about how I Will Always Love You was included in the movie. And he says, the song I Will Always Love You almost wasn't. It was supposed to be in the movie, but the first choice for that song was What Becomes of a Broken Heart. So What Becomes of Broken Hearts? Whitney returns home today to the place where it all began, and I urge us all, inside and outside, across the nation, across the world, to dry our tears, suspend our sorrow, perhaps our anger, just long enough to remember the sweet miracle of Whitney. And basically everybody in the, you know, the packed funeral, everybody was kind of on pins and needles. It was nice. It was quiet as could be while he was speaking. And you could tell, you know, what a moving speech it was and how everybody was just brought to tears. It's a special thing. And if you like this movie and you like Kevin Costner and Whitney Houston, it's definitely something worth checking out.
Wow. So how about that? I Will Always Love You was almost never in the movie. And I know, you know, obviously Whitney Houston synonymous with music as part of this and performing songs in this. And I know you got something else about the musical part, or at least the accomplished music that came out of this movie, right?
Well, it's kind of funny. We were talking earlier about how the movie, on a $25 million budget, made $411 million worldwide. Well, to this day, we are recording in early March 2018, I believe, and this is still the best-selling soundtrack of all time, with over 45 million copies sold worldwide. Still to this day, 26 years after the movie came out.
Any movie, any artists, any songs, anything, The Bodyguard 1992 far surpasses all of them.
Right. You know, and obviously the big hit from the movie was I Will Always Love You, written by Dolly Parton. Check this out. That single spent 14 weeks at number one on the Billboard Hot 100.
And you know, you and I can identify with this. We may have a younger audience that's listening here that doesn't realize how big a star Whitney Houston was in the late 80s and the early 90s. So it's not surprising that one of her songs would be there. And in particular, it shows the popularity of the movie, that the big song from the movie would be there.
Right. And we had talked earlier about how Run to You and I Have Nothing were nominated for Oscars. Well, this was also such a big deal. It was nominated for Grammys. And both those songs were nominated for Grammys. They did not win, but they were both up for the Grammys. But the Bodyguard soundtrack won Album of the Year at the Grammys. So we're just talking success all around this. And we mentioned the late Whitney Houston. The Whitney Houston Estate and Legacy Recordings released the I Wish You Love More from the Bodyguard back in for the 25th anniversary of the movie. And it kind of had a collection of never-before-released live recordings from when Whitney did a Bodyguard tour from 93 to 95. So she may be gone, but she still lives on through this movie and this soundtrack. I have one other Kevin Costner quick story to tell before we get to the critics thing. Back in 2015, I was privileged enough. I got to go to the Hyatt Regency over in downtown Dallas, and people see the downtown Dallas skyline with the ball. That is Reunion Tower, and the Hyatt Regency is connected to that. So it kind of puts you in the mind frame where I was. And it is an event was for a group called New Friends, New Life. And he was there. They were raising money for sex trafficking. And he was kind of the keynote speaker. We had a local movie critic, Gary Kogel, that kind of did like a little back and forth. And he told this amazing story. Like, you know, when you see him in this setting, And, you know, and you kind of you feel like you're friends with him. And I really hoped I could talk to him that day and ask him about our thing in Aspen. But, you know, unfortunately, I did not get to. But he's telling a story about when about how he is with fans. He's like, you know, I really appreciate the fans because I know that all the stuff that I've been able to do is because people like my work. And least I can do is shake someone's hand or take a photo with them or do an autograph or whatever. He's like, there's this one day I'm leaving the back lot at Warner. I'm walking to my car and I hear somebody call me out, call Kevin, say, hey, Mr. Costner. And he's like, I'm far enough away that I probably could have gotten away with acting like I didn't hear her. But for whatever reason, it came over me as I turned around. And I said, yeah, how you doing? And she said, sir, I just wanted to tell you something, that my husband has been gone off at war and he was missing in action. And it, the part you had in Dances with Wolves where you were missing and your wife always believed you were there, that's the only thing that kept me going.
Wow.
And he ended up coming back and he made it. And but the only way that I was able to survive was through your movie. And he's telling this story. I'm in a room of probably 2,000 people that all paid, you know, $500 a head to go to this lunch. Every one of them, not a dry eye in the house. Everybody's crying, wiping their eyes and stuff. And then it gets even better. He says, so what he did, he went back to the original film, and cut out the scene where he returns back and cut it out and found this woman and gave it to her. So she has the original film, the original stock.
Really?
From that movie. He did that because, you know, she apparently worked somewhere close by. That's how she was able to see him coming out. And, you know, obviously I'm not telling the story nearly as great as he did that day. And, you know, if you ever have a chance to see him when he's out speaking, I'm sure that this is a story he'll tell, because you could tell it was one of those things where he's like, he knows that some small little thing he did that took no effort on his part made that woman's life, you know?
Well, and this is the impact that you have, and you don't even realize it, with thousands, if not tens of thousands, your roles, your entertainment, the things that you can do impacts people that you never know. I mean, he got a chance to interact with somebody and find out, but you have thousands, if not tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, or millions of people that you impact because of your celebrity and how you carry yourself. Bravo to Kevin Costner. How about that?
Good,
from Memento.
Good dude. Yeah, good dude. And it's one of those stories where I couldn't wait. I went with my good friend Catherine Dunn. If you ever want to look her up online, she's one of the most beautiful women in the world. She and I went together, and both of us were teared up listening to that. And when we left, I could not wait to call my mom and tell her that story. You know, because like my dad and I go back and forth because Dance with Wolves is one of his favorite movies, and I'm like, this movie's 3 hours, it's boring. You know, but anyways, going back to that story for just a second, that's one of those things where a lot of times you don't hear those kind of stories. You hear all the bad stuff, the TMZ. You know, the stuff that ends up on entertainment and networks like E and stuff like that. But this was a great story, and I wish more people knew it.
I hear you on that. All right, so what did the critics say? We got to wind it down here on The Bodyguard.
We are winding down. Let me go positive first. We have Mr. Roger Ebert, who we always mention, the late Roger Ebert. He gave it 3 stars. And he kind of – it's one of those you can tell he enjoyed it, but he didn't love it. He goes through, he says, it may look like a romance, but it's actually a study of two lifestyles, of a pop music superstar whose fame and fortune depends on millions of fans, and of a professional bodyguard who makes his living protecting her from those fans. The movie does contain a love story, but it's the kind of guarded passion that grows between two people who spend a lot of time keeping their priorities straight. So that's Roger Ebert. He liked it. The Washington Post, Desson Howe, did not like it at all. And I'm not going to read the entire thing, but I will I'll start at the beginning. It says, in The Bodyguard, short-haired security agent Kevin Costner has to protect Whitney Houston from a mysterious marauder, but all the training and discipline in the world are no match for Lawrence Kasdan's script, an assassin of logic and believability.
Well, and
not a fan.
And he didn't even knock the video premiere at the club where, again, she's dressed like a mutant movie star from a bad B-movie science fiction movie that would be on Mystery Science Theater 3000.
Exactly. Anyone who wants to see this, we do this every time, though.
You read these reviews with it, and the bottom line is the public loved this. That's why it made over $400 million.
Critic,
the public didn't care.
Proof. Yeah. How about that? Critic proof.
All right, so we've sufficiently covered it with The Bodyguard. Again, that's another one in the category that I can't believe that's been 25 years, and Costner's still going strong, making the movies. I like a lot of his other roles, and I do like the fact that this one is intertwined within The Line of Fire and even The West Wing with Secret Service agents and trying to love triangle, love stories, and somebody's going to take a bullet and that kind of stuff. Hollywood seems to like that theme. They like that mindset.
Well, you know what he likes is he likes Westerns. And yes. The next thing he has coming up is that the Paramount Network is going to have a show this summer called Yellowstone. And he's on that. And the blurb on that says it's a ranching family in Montana face off against each other.
You just prompted me with another one. And what is he? Is he Charlie in Open Range with Robert Duvall?
Yes.
Charlie as the gunslinger, as the killer that ends up with Annette Bening. He's better as Charlie than he is as Frank Farmer. If we keep doing this, I'm going to go through like 8 more Costner roles that I like better than in The Bodyguard. But The Bodyguard,
you mentioned
solid.
Clint Eastwood played Frank Horrigan.
That's right.
You remember that?
That's
and then,
right.
Also, he and Clint Eastwood had a movie together, A Perfect World, where he played the bad guy, Butch Haynes. Did you ever see that one?
How about that? I have not seen that one. That's another feature.
It's an entertaining one. It's more of a, it's one of those that was kind of a smaller deal.
What I had
those two huge stars in it.
What I've come to understand on We've Seen That for the audience that's listening and go back and catalog our movies, you will hear time and again that I have not seen something that Jay has seen. I'm pretty well assured if it's anything of prominence from the 80s, 90s, or early 2000s, Jay has seen it, and I'm sort of in his league on We've Seen That, but most everything he's seen and would know and would be an expert. American Flyers, by the way, the cycling movie, Costner, Alexandra Paul, Ray Dong Chong, he's fantastic in that, and that's before anybody knew who Kevin Costner was.
The guy that wrote Breaking Away.
Yeah, fantastic movie, and it didn't get any kind of box office or critical acclaim, but go spend $2 on Netflix or find it on the internet. Find American Flyers for Kevin
Jake
Costner.
Jake and Silverado, too. You liked him, right?
Yes. So, I mean, there's so many of those, for sure. All right, did you have fun with The Bodyguard, Kevin Costner, and the late Whitney Houston on this one?
How could you not? I mean, what better movie to celebrate the Oscars than a movie that takes place at the Oscars?
Hopefully they keep it safe. For the next one, what do you think? It's March coming up. It's March Madness coming up. Wait a minute. I smell a theme.
I'm thinking maybe one of the greatest actors of our time, Gene Hackman.
Oh, Coach Norman Dale. Did we get to talk about Coach Norman Dale and Hoosiers?
Let's talk Hoosiers.
Coming soon to We've Seen That via Blog Talk Radio or iTunes or Stitcher, we will talk Hoosiers and the classic from the 1980s of the small-town Indiana team. The miracle, Milan, Indiana did it in real life. The Hickory Huskers did it on film, won the state championship of Indiana basketball. I can't wait to talk about that.
The great Jimmy Chitwood.
Oh, Jimmy Chitwood and Norman Dale and Shooter and it's tremendous. So let's do that one on the next one. I had fun with you on The Bodyguard on this one, reliving that 1992 box office smash hit with Kevin Costner and Whitney Houston.
Absolutely. Thanks, TJ.
There's the famous Jay Betzel. Follow him on Twitter at the famous Jay. Again, follow this show at We've Seen That on Twitter, on Facebook and Instagram. Whether you found us on Blog Talk Radio, iTunes, or Stitcher, subscribe to the show. iTunes, Stitcher, go subscribe to the show. Then you get it automatically once we update a new episode. Rank the show. Help us promote the show as well. For the famous Jay, I'm TJ Reeves. Hope you enjoyed our review of the 1992 mega box office smash hit movie, The Bodyguard. Bye.